And welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the members segment. We are talking with Sofia Smallstorm about the Sandy Hook inconsistencies and anomalies that, of course, asks us to consider a different picture than what we've been presented with. And what Sofia has done and collected this information is very, very interesting and enlightening and scary at the same time, of course. But one thing we haven't really gotten into yet, Sofia, that I want to ask you more about is, who was Adam Lanza then, and his family and everything around him? What happened there? What do we know there so far?
Well, again, I'm speculating, but you could call it informed speculation. I mean, it's not ignorant speculation, if I could be so bold as to award that to myself. But there's no social security number for Adam Lanza. And in my presentation, I refer to a very seasoned investigative type who has looked for this and hasn't found it. And there are so many aliases around these people, not Adam, but Nancy Lanza, Peter Lanza, that you have to ask yourself, I mean, how many aliases do normal people have? When they move here and live there, they don't all have six different names. So that's very peculiar by itself. And the fact that, you know, the Lanza house was a black hole, nobody knew them, yet everybody, all these players lived right around them. I mean, people's backyards abutted the Lanza's backyard. And the stories, again, this is what I call the 2D world, the facts don't all fit together. They don't dovetail. It doesn't work. And how many weeks and months should we spend discussing this and trying to prove otherwise? I'm saying Adam Lanza is a convenience. That's what he is. That's the fiction that was imposed on the story, given to the media to run with, that bits and pieces about this family were planted here and there on the internet, so there was some kind of trail. But, you know, if you and I conspire to do something and we have all the time in the world to prepare it, we could start 10 years earlier. And we could put stuff everywhere, hide these little nuggets like Easter eggs. And people would find them later. And people would start hazarding guesses as to how it all fits. So I think this is what happened. And the ongoing part of the drill is the surveillance of the society, the surveying of the society reacting to this story. And then the society comports itself appropriately and accordingly. We now worry about people barging into schools or anywhere. I watched the Bonnie and Clyde remake on television that preceded the Sandy Hook anniversary by a couple of days. It was a four-hour miniseries aired on three networks, A&E, Lifetime, and I believe it was the History Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat in front of my TV and I literally cringed and flinched at the rain of bullets throughout this thing. And the theme song was sung by Nico Vega. It's an old Nancy Sinatra song. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to read you the lyrics. You can go to, just Google Nico Vega, Bonnie Clyde, Bang, Bang. But it's a very haunting song. It's beautifully performed until it just deteriorates into a wild, frenzied, you know, rain of bullets itself. This is the music video. I was five and he was six. We rode on horses made of sticks. He wore black and I wore white. He would always win the fight. Bang, bang, he shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down. And as they played, you know, little advertisements for this Bonnie and Clyde special for weeks in advance, and they always played Bang Bang, My Baby Shot Me Down, that song. And then I was thinking, imagine Nancy Lanza singing this, Bang Bang, My Baby Shot Me Down, before he left the house. and rode off to the Sandy Hook school and shot a bunch of other people. So this, the feeling you're left with after watching this special is literally, oh my God, it's all semi-automatic weapons that that Bonnie and Clyde use in this film. You just want semi-automatic and automatic weapons just taken off the globe entirely. Because it's all senseless killing. Senseless. And it was done for a reason. They spent tons of money making this show, and they aired it once. That's it.
Hmm. What's the bigger purpose of that? Do you think it's to shape the minds of the people watching ahead of time? What is that about, the deeper psychological impact of that, do you think?
Well, they showed it 1 year after Sandy Hook. And this was, in my mind, a way to further influence people to want, I guess you could call it, it's another gun control scam, you know, this video. But Henrik, there is a new trend in publishing. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's been around since the 90s, but I just became aware of it. The most popular arena of book publishing, and now it has extended into newspapers and magazines, feature stories. It's called, are you ready? Creative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And in creative nonfiction, you write very grippingly. You write so that it reads like a story. And the Bonnie and Clyde movie was massive creative nonfiction. It completely flipped around what Bonnie was like and what Clyde was like. I mean, Bonnie was the hanger-on in history. But in this movie, no, Bonnie was the one who said, we've got to go to bigger banks and bigger guns. And
that's an important point, because that's a way to basically, you rewrite history in this way. And the only historic references most people have today is, you know, they watch some, you know, History Channel specials on what the Vikings were like. And then that's it. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, there were other things that went on in this Bonnie and Clyde movie. It was Clyde who turned them all in. Clyde was such a wuss that he couldn't stand camping in the woods anymore and hiding from the law. He got tired of it, so he made a deal with the posse, the sheriff, I think it was in real life, a retired Texas Ranger. And Clyde gave them away on Louisiana State Highway 54, where in actuality the posse let loose 130 rounds, and there were six officers, and this was another rain of bullets. They, you know, rattled off, I think it was Bonnie and Clyde were each shot more than 50 times, 25 wounds per corpse, some other people say, but the car was just completely dented and ripped to shreds with bullets. But anyway, the idea was Clyde turned them all in, because here we go again with the modeling. The male is the wimp. You know, the woman was the one who was the real leader here. So this is, again, more subtle modeling, but it's a complete reversion of history. And that's creative nonfiction.
Right.
Now, there is a website called creativenonfiction.org. The publisher of the magazine is Lee Gutkin. And he says that creative nonfiction can be an essay, a journal article, a research paper, a memoir, a poem. Creative nonfiction is like jazz, a rich mix of flavors, ideas, and techniques, some of which are newly invented and others as old as writing itself. The words creative and nonfiction describe the form. The word creative refers to the use of literary craft, the techniques fiction writers, playwrights, and poets employ to present nonfiction. Factually accurate prose about real people and events in a compelling, vivid, dramatic manner. But you know what? Nobody's checking. You can say, yeah, this is creative nonfiction, this new book of mine, but nobody is going to go and check what you wrote. And there are authors out there who are fastidious, and they do check over and over and over. They double, and if the Buick was blue, they need to have two people from history say that it was blue.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least two, if not three. But, you know, who's really going to do this? This comes out of your own personal ethics. And when you have a team of people and they're crafting a story and they want to create a message to shape the public mind, well, you know, all bets are off. Then you just, it becomes a competition for who can be the most creative.
Yeah.
And so this is how it, as you say, it goes down on the record as a special, and the public assumes, oh, if it's on the History Channel, then it's got to be true, you know?
Right.
And they say things like, based on a true story, inspired by real events.
Yeah, I love those when they come. And that's also a way for people at this time to, for example, project modern values upon older times. I mean, it's done in series like, you know, Mad Men, and there's just a slew of these out there right now where they just like, you know, they take a value judgment that we've made today within the current mold of society and then project it onto an older generation or something like that. And when I see that, it's really disrespectful to all of our ancestors in that way. And they're trying to, you know, in some cases show what, you know, fools they were or brutes or idiots or, you know, in this kind of way. There's no virtue, if you will, in looking at history for what it really was, with an accurate lens, you know what I mean, and without that moral judgment all the time that we have today, you know.
Right. Well, I think there are individual responses as well to these programs, and then there are group responses, and they're looking for. I think they're looking at everything. They want the whole Facebook thing, you know, where you post pictures of your trip to Greece and everybody can see how much your daughters have grown. This kind of thing. They want all that data. It's all being amassed. And they're literally, they are reading us. They can make novels out of this, you know. Every one of us becomes something on the record. And then they can predict the trends, create the trends, modify the trends. And all we'll do is respond, because all you have is the container of your own life. That's it. You do not have the periscope on everyone like they do. And with the giant computing machines they have, they can really see what we're all about now. That's pretty amazing.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's unprecedented. We've never seen that in history before. And so more directly, I know that this occurs in many different fields and many agencies and everything else, but if we would to look at the apex of that pyramid, if you will, who is studying us and what is the purpose? Is it predictability and control of the human species and shaping the future, or is there more to it than that?
I think they're making the post-human society. And, you know, some people will say, well, what do you mean post-human? Humans are humans. Who's going to be in the post-human society? But the human form is being altered. And this is what some of my other talks have been about. If you just go to YouTube and type in From Chemtrails to Pseudo-Life, and you watch the full version, part one, and there's a part two, then you will start seeing how they're modifying us from the sub parts of the cell upward. Mm-hmm. And it's all being done through frequency response, piezoelectricity. There are very sophisticated nanotechnological experiments going on in our bodies today. And I believe it's correct that we have been transformed already from Homo sapien to Homo evolutus. We are in the transhuman corridor. So they are creating the post-human society. We are the transhumans that are being employed as living laboratories and observable units, and in our own groups as well, the group within the group within the group within the group. And this is all being observed and studied, and we are further going to be manipulated to become the object of this, the post-human specimen. And there will be, you know, I guess, varieties of that too.
Do you want to elaborate on that? What do you mean, varieties?
Well, are you aware that the natural world is dying? Simple question.
I've thought about that for a long time, yeah.
Yeah, I am. I live on a 13-acre canyon. I'm looking at it now. It's pathetic, but anybody who couldn't understand trees would say, no, it's beautiful. What do you mean it's pathetic? But I'm looking at sycamores that have still not lost their leaves from last summer. I would say I'm looking at two sycamores next to one another, and they've each got about 30% of their leaves still on them. And other trees are already budding. We've had 75, 80 degrees for many weeks here in Northern California, and it's been December, January. And people are in flip-flops and shorts. People are jumping into the ocean, even though that's still pretty cold. But wherever there's an old leaf still clinging, it means that when the new leaves bud, nothing is going to be able to bud there, because that spot is still being taken out by a dying leaf, which isn't dead yet. So the trees are all sick. The species of all living things are going out at extraordinary rates, I believe. The tree species are conifers, the pine trees. They're going to cone. That means they're producing cones every year. They're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to do that every 10 or 15 years. But I have noticed the rain of cones in my driveway and the pollen everywhere. This is a last-ditch reproductive effort on the part of the tree. The trees in Sweden, I learned this year, all went red, all at once, all of them, without going orange first, the leaves. And I looked that up, and that has to do with anthocyanins. That is a pigment that the tree puts out, and it protects, because the chlorophyll production has died off as the sunlight is waning. It's getting to be winter. The leaves start getting yellow, and they start dying and falling off. Well, right before they're going to really die and fall off, the tree throws out red, and that is a sunscreen that saves the leaf just a little bit longer while the tree transfers nutrients from the leaf that's soon going to fall off, into the more permanent parts of itself, into the bark and the trunk. So when you see a flush of red all at once with no orange preceding it, it means this tree is in distress. It's transferring nutrients as fast as possible because its leaves are going to fall off. And when you times that by thousands and thousands and thousands of trees, you've got a world in distress.
Hmm.
And so, in my view, the Monsantos in our midst are going to say, don't worry about a few trees. Yes, we've lost 3,000 species of trees in the last 10 years, but, you know, we have trees. We've made nice GMO trees. They're very hardy. And we have 12 different kinds, and you can have two in your yard. And people will go, oh, wow, great. And they will happily pay the licensing fee.
So it's an artificial realm, obviously, that's being created to take over the role of the natural one, a mechanized version of it. Now, the question there, though, is this a natural shut down, or if this is this artificially induced as well, do you think, man-made or something else?
Oh, is the expiring of the natural world natural? Well, it's a response to what's happening. There are a lot of assaults. There are chemtrails, there are, you know, GMOs, there's hybridization going on rapidly in the natural world from non-natural influx. Yeah, there's all this crazy engineered weather. These sub-zero temperatures are created by what's called ice nucleation. And I hope I'm delivering this accurately, but I just learned from Dane Wigington a few weeks ago that when they combine ammonium hydroxide and barium in the atmosphere, of course they artificially put these chemicals up there, they can create what's called an endothermic reaction. That means it sucks the heat out. So the reaction itself of these two elements combining, ammonium hydroxide is a compound, combining will create a sub-zero temperature instantly. So this is how they're getting these freezing temperatures on the eastern seaboard. And in the Midwest now, people are telling me, oh, it's minus 22 this weekend. People are staying in their houses. Their energy bills are freaky.
Mm.
So these are all ways that, and you know, when you do endothermic reactions, they take moisture with them. Because with heat going like that, all the moisture is sucked up. So it's a way of drying out the lower atmosphere chemically in an engineered fashion. And you think about it, Henrik, where are the little animals going? How are they surviving, the gophers and the little tiny birds, and even the bigger animals, the foxes? Where are they living when it's minus 22 outside, day after day after day after day? What is happening to them? And what is happening to the life itself, the flora and fauna? How are they surviving? Can sleeping parts of those life forms take that kind of cold? It's extreme cold. So it's shocking the species, many, many, many species all at once.
Yeah, well, I think it's been said too that we're part, basically, ongoing in another extinction event right now. If it's the sixth or fifth or whatever, I can't keep track of them. There's been a number of them in the past, and it's an interesting point. And let's see if we can return to that, because I don't want to just yet leave Sandy Hook. I wanted to return there, if that's all right with you, Sophia, and
sure.
Just talk a little bit more about some of those components within that. And I guess while we're on the topic of trees, let's talk about the Christmas trees that were shipped in. Was it a day or two ahead of the actual event itself that was later put on display as being donated by somebody? Weird things like this.
The Christmas trees were appeared. They were being carried by firemen. They were being carried out of the Sandy Hook firehouse and lined up on the road and then decorated, and that was the 15th of December, and there were 26 of them. Now, the sharp-eyed among us, I wasn't one of them. Well, actually, I didn't watch a lot of TV, but I even failed to see this in photos myself, in aerial footage. It was a friend, a very close research friend of mine, who saw what she thought were bushes or trees behind the firehouse. There was a tight little bundle of them. And another guy told me that he saw it on December 14th as they were showing us aerial footage. He said, "What are those strange bushes behind the firehouse?" And turns out they were the bundled up Christmas trees that were put out the next day. And they were done to commemorate the Sandy Hook victims. So isn't that weird? And then we're told, you know, the media just slips it in that there was a woman donor from North Carolina who got wind of the pending firehouse Christmas tree sale and thought, wouldn't it be nice if I bought all those trees and donated them to the town to decorate in memory of the victims?
Mm.
So, I mean, maybe, yes. But again, Sandy Hook is full of little gems like this.
Yeah.
But when you in the aerial footage, you just say, what?
The people walking around in circles, going around into the building again, just walking around. I mean, again, that implies that a lot of people, all right, either they just agree to do it, whatever they're being told for the purpose of it, or, I mean, all those, what could that have been? At least 100 people, if not even more, were walking around in that matter. They know that they're what they're doing, correct? And what they're part of.
Right. What's odd about the aerial footage of the firehouse is, first of all, I see very few children. Second of all, I see people just ambling. And yes, if you study the, you know, like ants make a little trail, they make a little path, and they all go on that path. Well, you see this trail of people moving in one door, and then they come out the other door of the firehouse, and then they walk right back around the side of the building into the door again that they first came into, and they keep doing this. And then there are others of them that just amble around, and they have their hands in their pockets. There's a guy in a yellow windbreaker or jacket, and he's wearing shorts. He looks very West Coast, actually, And all he's doing is he walks around this pile of stuff, and then he quickly turns and walks the other way again. Then he stops, and he swivels and walks in another direction, and then he turns and he walks back. And where is he going? What's his purpose? What's he doing? It's very clear that he has no purpose. He's not going anywhere. He's just a warm body moving around. And you start looking at all these people and you go, wow, where's the frenzy? Where's the chaos? Where are the parents saying, where's my kid? Nobody is out of control. They're all just like a little colony of ants. And they must be on task. They must be doing something they were told to do, because nobody's acting particularly naturally, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you have your hands in your pockets, people put their hands in their pockets when they're cold, so that could be the reason, or when they have nothing to do, or both.
Right. Could there be something stranger with the entire community going on in terms of, you know, there's a couple of different possibilities there that either, all right, they're all, you know, in on it, they're playing these parts, if you will, in it, or there's something. I mean, you brought attention to the idea that there's also very strong Baha'i faith, you know, cult session that was going on after the shootings and other. Well, I couldn't see it anything else as a ritual where you had one of the interfaith leaders basically talking about, you know, thanking the divine, you know, precedents for freeing some of these individuals from this what they call the dark and gloomy cage. This is very, it's a very anti. anti-life kind of sentiment within these rituals that was going on, which is very kind of, it's kind of creepy to me. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, that is very peculiar. And now, just to go to the beginning of what you said, the people ambling, they might not have even been from Newtown. We don't even know who they were. I mean, they could have been imported just for that little scene. So, they're not necessarily Newtonians, but as far as the Baha'i thing goes, the first person to bring that up was the person where I discovered it, the sandyhooktruth.wordpress.com, and she researched that a little bit, and then James Tracy wrote a very good piece about it, and I refer to that in my presentation, Newtown, New World Order, Religion, I think it's titled. And it's about John Woodall, Harvard psychiatrist, who has the Unity Project headquarters in Newtown. And another friend who's pretty good on some of these religions wrote to me and said that that's not what the Baha'i faith was about originally.
Right.
But it has been, you could say, recast now, and it's headquartered. I think the Baha'i was Palestinian at first, but now it's headquartered in Haifa, Israel, and it really calls for a lot of things that reek of traditional kind of socialist New World Order, one world everything, one
yeah.
world religion, one world legislator, one world everything, language, one world currency. So this is, again, the hive. Everybody will just swing along. In this one world rhythm.
I think a lot of United Nations representatives are into the Baha'i faith heavily as well. There's a lot of money in that too. I mean, look at some of the temples. I know they have one in LA. They have one, as you said, in Haifa, in Israel. They have, they're scattered a little bit here and there. And it's an interesting, you know, cult.
Yeah, it's probably bigger than that. It's probably a global movement that we're not able, the average person isn't able to see as a global movement yet, but that you bring up that the UN people are into this, that's telling.
So Agenda 21 fits into this in a certain way. What more can you say about this a testing ground as an environment for things to come as well, of this, I guess, to a certain extent, acceptance, but then also the admission to that when these circumstances happen, this idea that you're not there to kind of set things straight or try to sort this out, but you just kind of turn the other cheek as a, you know, as a docile person who's it's a way, in a way, that they're engineering the new human to lack the basic responses even and flare up in anger and try to, you know, protect your children even in that regard. That's what I feel has gone on here as well. Do you think I'm right?
Yes. I think that the natural human defenses and reflexes to protect and self-preserve and act autonomously and proactively, those are all being reconditioned completely. We're being taught how to be acquiescent and docile, as you say, yielding, compliant, pleasant. I mean, it's almost like a, you know, what did they, Soma or something like that? You know, remember
yeah,
that drug?
Yeah, that was in Huxley's, I believe, the drug yeah. that everyone was pleasantly aroused by getting because it hit the pleasure centers or something like that, and everyone was happy, yeah.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something. I was once in Chicago O'Hare Airport, and I had, my plane was really off schedule. It was delayed so long, and there was an Air France there that was delayed 24 hours, okay? And so O'Hare was a mess. O'Hare is the United hub. And strangely, Henrik, I wasn't all freaked out. I was very calm. I went and bought some tea, and I sat and read my magazine. And then I was changed to a different gate, and I ambled along to another gate. I was there for many hours. But the whole time, I was surprised at myself how okay I was with this hellish delay. And the Air France people were so mellow. I was eventually transferred over to their area, which is how I found out about how late their plane was. And they were all happy and, you know, just chatting nicely. I had some great conversations. I had some lovely chamomile tea a few times from Starbucks. And I noticed when I was walking O'Hare to get from this gate to that gate and going other places because I had all this time to kill, it was just so aromatic. It smelled phenomenal. At one point, I smelled roses, and I was looking around to see what woman was wearing this amazing scent of roses, and there was nobody around me. Another time I smelled vanilla cookies, and I looked for the Mrs. Fields cookies, and there was nothing. And another time I smelled cinnamon, and then it hit me when I got back to San Diego that perhaps we were being calmed down by chemicals. And you could say this was aromatherapy and everybody gets really relaxed and they smell roses like that. But I think there was more to it. I think there was chemical dissemination in O'Hare to alter and calm down the passengers psychologically. And I did ask, there was some kind of convention going on and a bunch of those people had flown the plane with me to San Diego. And they were all in neurology or neurotech type people. And I asked one of them, I had been talking to her, I said, did you smell all these amazing smells in Chicago? She said, yes. And we discussed this, and she thought that this was very possible as well.
I know that they have, they've turned to what they call scent marketing in some of the grocery stores, which is very much basically what you talk about. It's a company called Scent Air that basically sprays out different scents, you know, obviously the appropriate ones over whatever area in the grocery store you're at. But it wouldn't be, I think, too far to say that they would maybe extend an experiment like this to an airport, for example, so that when delays happen and people get, you know, uncomfortable and weary and everything else, they would just, you know, spray out a little bit of that thing. And maybe it helps, you know, maybe it helps to calm people down. But you think that there might be something more in there, basically. That's what you're saying.
Yes. It's not just, I think there's chemical alteration of the neurological response, because at the time they were having some terrible fires here in San Diego, and I actually left New York early so that I could come back, because my area I was calling friends, and a lot of places here were being evacuated, and I just didn't know what to expect. And so I saw the fires from the sky. I looked down and saw them, and that is quite something. It was nighttime, and I could see the just rivers of burning red and flaming. And you would think that I'd be really, really anxious. But no, waiting in O'Hare, knowing that my house could be on fire? Why should I be calm sipping chamomile tea like that? It doesn't make sense. I know me, you know.
All right.
That was very unusual.
Now, let's just cover this as well, because I think there might be some people who are wondering, all right, with all the things we've been talking about so far here, what actually happened to the kids? We can just explain that, and what do you think from your point of view, what happened here? Because, I mean, were people sacrificed? Were people just never shot? Did they disappear? Were they taken elsewhere? What happened to the kids?
Well, Henrik, you have to ask if there were six-year-olds with those names and faces at all, or if those were just conveniences too. There is a Church of Satan in Newtown, and there's a Masonic Lodge right there. And I was contacted by somebody in law enforcement from Connecticut who told me privately that he is aware and has been made aware of how much satanic activity goes on in that little part of Connecticut. And it may all be true, but if you start talking about that, then the tendency is to say that the children were ritually sacrificed, right? And then that departs from the possibility that nobody was in that building. And so where do you land? So I go with the question, which is a really overwhelmingly powerful question in my mind. The Sandy Hook School, first of all, I know people who have gone and looked at it. Of course, there was a fence around it at the time. It was after the event, before it was torn down. And one of these people was a professional lifelong teacher, and he said, there's no way you could have fit 450, 500 kids in that school, maybe 250. Then we saw these photos in the police report, just peeling paint, this really decrepit interior, and the exterior was decrepit from the reports I got. And this was a vanguard, progressive, state-of-the-art school? Come on. So you have to ask yourself, was it in use? We've never seen pictures of children being evacuated from that school on that day. We're not hearing from the children who are in the community. So what happened to the kids? What kids? I don't know. I couldn't tell you whether Sandy Hook was an elementary school in full business, you could say, or not, in full session. I don't know. And that, then you have to say, well, who went there? Where did they, I mean, what schools operate in Newtown? I mean, unfortunately, I'm not there. I can't go and ask those questions. And you can't just call up, you know, you're not going to get the right answers from people. So I wish that I could read minds and I could find out who in Newtown cares, who mm-hmm. in Bethel, yeah. that's a neighboring town, cares, you know, or knows all of this. But we saw no bodies. We had a very bizarre coroner talking about how he had very creative photographers, and the parents don't seem to be fazed by anything, those people who are supposed to be the parents, so I don't know.
They haven't demanded to see the body. I mean, I'm surprised at that too. If there are so many inconsistencies, and if they're not part of it or knows what is going on, which is that once CNN, I think it was, or was it MSNBC? No, it was CNN with the CIA, Anderson Cooper. He did an interview with the family who's there, and it almost, when I watched that, it almost seemed to me that they found out that it was just a drill or something, and your daughter is alive, and you guys just please play along with this because it's better in the bigger picture, and you know, we'll give you you know, money for it or something like that. I don't know, because as you pointed out, where is the sadness and the trauma of this? I mean, I've just, even just losing a cat, you can be like emotionally, you know, upset for days afterwards. You can't just, you know, think about it in the same way and just talk about it even, you know what I mean? And in this case, it was, I don't know if they shape up because they're on TV and in front of the cameras or something, but it seems very bizarre. So therefore, to me, it's very surprised that some of the people have been so quiet around there. And where are those who would, you know, inquire on the website or contact local media even? I mean, I haven't seen that anyway, where they just kind of question what really happened. So it seems very homogenized in the way that it's been planned out, and the people have kind of basically followed order and followed suit, right?
Yeah, I mean, these people are acting like they haven't lost anything, I have to say. That's my objective assessment. They do not act like people who have lost children. So I'm not even going to use the word parents, because it's very possible they're not the parents of who we were told they are. So they're not parents in that operating sense. They're people. And they act like people who haven't lost anything. Hey, I lost my favorite little shopping bag that I take to the grocery store. I went to the store the other day, and it's not in my car. And I was trying to think about, oh, my God, where did I last see it? And I thought, it's lost. And I had to counsel myself to let go of it. And I'm thinking, why am I getting so upset about a stupid little bag? Can you imagine if it was a person?
Right.
So really, really, either I am a hellish neurotic myself, which, okay, over certain things, yes. But no, these people don't act like they have lost anything. This isn't a true signs of bereavement.
Yeah.
And I gave a little spiel in my presentation about crying, you know, the tears, and how when you cry, you don't care who sees you. You
right.
will bawl
yeah.
if you have to. I mean, you really, you will spend days and days and days with a swollen face and puffy eyes, and you'll, you know, break down every 5 seconds. And this is not happening.
Yep, it's very, very bizarre, and it's very, very strange. So how do you view media on top of this mainstream media in terms of are they lacking? I mean, you brought that up is a good point in terms of the inconsistency in the reporting. And as I said before, okay, you would have some versions of that in terms of the fact that they want to get the story out first kind of thing, which, you know, gives a disadvantage in that regard. But nonetheless, in terms of asking some of these questions or investigating, I mean, do you even think that we should expect more from, you know, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, ABC, and all these channels? Or is it just another entertainment network and people to put too much weight and credence on them for sorting out these issues for us? What do you think?
Well, Henrik, I knew some people who worked for the networks back in the day of 9/11 when it just happened, and they were instructed not to show any footage of the towers falling, not to use the word explosion, and they were the lower people on the rungs of the ladder. And I believe there are lower ranking people in there today. And those people may have had serious questions. But when you're given these orders and, you know, you're looked at a certain way, you just comply. But the people like Anderson Cooper, who I heard was a Rothschild, I don't know if it's true, you know, he's part of the all-seeing eye. He's got to know what's going on. That's what I think. And so should we expect more from the media? Well, if we know that this is how they are, we can't expect anything from them. And I actually have had conversations with people in the media, and this was in the day of 9/11 when I was being interviewed and contacted for various things. And I will tell you that the reporters themselves and some of the lower level producers were absolutely convinced that 9/11 wasn't what their companies had put out on the airwaves. But I got from one guy that his pay grade simply wasn't high enough to make much of a difference. And another reporter was crying on the phone to me after she saw 9/11 Mysteries, and she said, "What should I do? What should I do?" I said, "Do your job. Do your job." But they can't. They cannot do their job because not only would they be fired, but they might be harmed as well, you know? And these are the things that people fear.
Yeah, indeed. Anderson Cooper, by the way, just to set that somewhat straight, it could be interminglings with the Rothschilds, of course, but he's part of the Vanderbilt family.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
And he has an interesting background there with the CIA and everything else. A couple of stories that came out a couple of years ago. We'll link those up for people who want to look into that more. Part of the upper crust, if you will, there. But it's very interesting, and we have to just continue to ask those questions about this. What else do you want to add to this now in terms of something big that we've left out or anything else, thoughts you have around this or how we could get closer to a kind of a final answer about what really has gone on here?
I don't know how close we're going to get. I mean, we might have a general picture, but I don't know how close we're going to get as to what really went on, because as it slips farther and farther into time, you know, we lose our grip on it. We might be able to go deeper on certain issues, but new things happen. I mean, right after Sandy Hook, there was Boston, the Boston bombing,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was racing to that to figure out what happened there. And then there were these parallels, and people were saying, oh, the same actors were used, and, you know, they jump to conclusions and they make some of the wrong connections. I think I've done that myself. But Henrik, I want to say this, to go back to the what should we expect from mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
Henrik, you are the media. You.
We all are. Everyone who asks questions and knows how to put it online. That's media right there.
Right. We work with media. Yeah. Websites, articles, interviews, they're all media. But it's people like your platform, radio station, if you want to call it that. In fact, I got a call. It's very funny, but right before I was scheduled to go on with you, I got a call about, and it was actually from one of the utility companies, you could say, and they wanted to qualify me for solar something, a solar program. And I said, no, I've got to go on the radio in just a minute. I've got to go. And it was a young kid, and he says to me, the radio, what radio? I said, Red Ice Radio. He goes, what? I said, Red Ice. He's going, Red Ice? I said, yeah, Google it. You'll love it. I can tell from the sound of your voice you're going to love Red Ice Radio. Then I hung up.
Well, that's the way to do it. Spread that word about the broadcast.
No, but it's
no,
about
thanks.
Anything. I think people are so hungry to know more, and they don't know where to go.
Sure, yeah, that is true.
They don't know where to start to peel back the layers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is true. A lot of people are open-minded, they're curious, and they want to know. I think that it's something that has changed in people in that regard, and I can't tell you how many people that just, you know, discovered the program that I hear about, you know, almost every day, that they come across it in some way, or, you know, they just search for something and found it. And so there's an immense new, you know, hungry crowd that's coming in all the time. And so it's important to, you know, go back to the basics and bring things up again, because everyone is not up to speed. But then you want to try to look ahead and find some of the new highlight points as well in all of this. But I'm encouraged overall, though, that more and more people are asking the questions. And I feel there are a few, of course, who are very distinct, just says no to all this and shuts down. But, as displayed in the They Live analogy that we made before, I don't think you should spend your time too much to beat people up, to have them to put on the glasses. It'd have to be a spark within that already, a curiosity where they are ready to put on the glasses willingly, because they just have that drive within them. I think those are the kind of people that we wouldn't lose so much energy, if you know what I mean, in that regard.
Right. I mean, I wrote on my website somewhere, I think it's on the consciousness page of aboutthesky.com. That's another website I have. I wrote, each one of us who is awake is carrying 100,000 sleeping people. And I just pulled a number out of a hat, but people were contacting me saying, 100,000? Is that how many it is? And I said, look, it's just a number. It's a figure of speech. But yeah, we're carrying these people. And we're gently trying to wake them up. Sometimes you have to shake a person a few times on the shoulder before he even opens his eyes.
Sure, yeah.
So, and we have to do it with love. And I was talking to someone the other day, and he said, yeah, you know, rather than loving one person in this life, my work, my research, is my love for a lot of people. And I thought that was beautifully put.
Yeah, it's the love for the truth, the accuracy of just us enlightening the world and release the world from all the lies that we see and the propaganda and the engineering and everything else, because it's bringing us down and destroying mankind. The just immense social engineering of the species right now is so immense. And what you said, even with the actual physical transformation as well, we're seeing being turned into something else in front of our eyes, and it's not a pretty picture. So I think it's everyone's responsibility to speak out and talk about it, and become commentators of their own. So speak out of what they see and share it with their family members and friends and everything else. I think that's the only way that's gonna more and more people are gonna be brought into it in that way.
Yeah, information is the new kind of love, and yet you have to be. You have to choose your words correctly. I remember telling my mother, she was getting freaked out too much, but it works, about the terrible storms they were having. This was a couple of years ago on the East Coast, and another tree fell, and it cost thousands of dollars to have it cleaned up and stumped and taken out of the ground. And I said, well, yeah. I said, this is what the fake storms are doing. She said, fake storm? It was a real storm. It happened. I said, no, but it's engineered. And she said, okay, but don't say it's fake.
Yeah.
So
no,
exactly.
It's a good point. People have, they have different perceptions of the words that you use, and they see something else in front of their eyes. That's why it's very important to be careful with what words you use. And how you explain that as well. And I see personally, from my point of view, so many, misunderstandings occurring out there, even things I say, and people misunderstand that, or think that I meant something else and different. And it's like, slow down, take it easy, listen to what I say. And okay, I might have used the wrong word here and there, English is not my first language. It doesn't always come out exactly how you plan it to. So it's very tricky, but if people have the patience, and have the courage to just be persistent and keep asking questions and piece together things themselves in their head and think about the things that they learn, I think we have a good chance of getting there. Yeah,
but what are you going to do about, maybe we get there, but we're kind of all the Homo evolutus, and if Homo evolutus gets there, he doesn't really care about it.
Yeah.
I mean, we are in the transition phase still, so the cake is not baked yet.
That is true. I feel sometimes that there is a kind of a fork in the road. There is a split even in the species, and this very basic idea that some people are going down, and it's everyone is free to do as they please. I'm not here to tell people how to live their lives or anything like that, but I see one path of this is moving completely into the artificial and the mechanized, if you will, the implant kind of attitude, and the global, worldwide mind hooked up to the internet and everything else. And that's a kind of a clear distinction, I think, in people there. Either they're going to favor something which is more natural or authentic, or they're going to go for a more artificial technological path, and we can just talk about it as much as we see it, right, and try to make people have the right information so they can make the right choice, right?
Right. It's all about awareness, and it's all about, who do you really want to be? How do you really want to be? And I think we've forgotten how to be, how we started out. It's because the changes are really slow. They're incremental, and we forget how we once were,
Right.
And there's a lot of peer pressure to be a certain way as well.
Certainly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, more than ever, I think. It can't be easy to grow up as a child and teenager in this world. Jeez, I can't even imagine with all the social networks and everything else that goes on top of that.
A friend of mine told me her nephew, the only way she keeps in touch with her nephews is to go to their Facebook page, and she's got a nephew in his 30s, and he's all crazy about transhumanism. He can't wait.
Yeah, see?
So... and I think we also forsake ourselves because of the people around us. I know so many people who are parents, and their obligation is to put food on the table, and they just don't have the time for this or the energy, and they put their children first, which is, of course,
sure,
they have to do this. But it's sad that the lives we're living are so chock full of stuff that we don't have the energy to pay attention to this really important creeping change.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like the Grim Reaper. This is the stealth advancing of our souls being stolen out from under us.
Oh, certainly. It's the Fabian way. It's the very slow, incremental way that you boil the frog, and that's what's so dangerous about it, because if it was moving fairly, I mean, certainly in some instances it is moving fast, it is moving with quickness and speed, but nonetheless the overarching path, if you will, is so incremental that many people have a difficult seeing what really is going on, and that scares me. You know, people have to get a long-term, you know, chess player's kind of perspective on some of these things, otherwise they lose the plot. They're too close to the details to see the pictures, you know?
Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, Sophia, this has been a very interesting discussion. Thank you again for coming back with us, sharing your thoughts, your research on this and everything else surrounding that connects with this. Why don't we give out your websites again? And what do you have upcoming, by the way? Are you working on something new right now?
I'm working on what I'm working on. This is all volunteer, and I honestly don't know what's going to happen next. I do. I have made a discovery. I can tell you about that sometime, and maybe I'll be qualified to come on the air about it.
Certainly.
But, you know, each thing I do is just something I stumble into. And then I answer my own questions to the best of my ability and present that information for others, you know, as clearly as I can. And it just, if I'm invited to speak somewhere, it might go up on YouTube, or now I just gave this presentation myself in a small private home, the same one I did at ConspiracyCon about Sandy Hook, and I had it filmed, and I had a friend edit it. It went up on YouTube, and that's it. It's now pushing 140,000 views, I think, in
yeah,
a couple of months.
Yeah, that's great.
So, you know, again, we're not professionals here in the sense that we have any plan, or, you know, there's a trajectory, or there's a sequence to this kind of work or research. It's what grabs you and what you get impassioned to follow. And that's the best I can do. I can't really do anything else, because I don't know what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty good approach, I think, if you it will unfold in a natural and organic way. In that way, and I think you get the right person, if you will, for the right job, because those who are going to be most interested in something, or something, you know, as you said, that really speaks to you, is something you're going to look further into, and they're going to become professionals and experts almost in the area that they look into. And the more research they do and piece it together, they are certainly going to offer a whole lot more better and coherent picture than the mainstream media is doing. So it's all good in my eyes. It might not. Every conclusion, everything you see out there might, of course, not be true, but that's not the point. The idea there is to get you to question these things, put it in perspective, compare it what you've learned before, and you know, evolve and progress forward in your knowledge base, you know, with that. But thank you again, then, Sophia. Please give us your website again so people know where to go.
Okay, there's avatarproducts.com. That's my store. Then there's my website, aboutthesky.com. And that is about the sky. One person thought I said about this guy, and it was about relationships. I said, no, about the sky. Yeah, so the rabbit hole page there, it has my Sandy Hook presentation on it. But honestly, I don't post on that site too much right now. I'm really doing more ferreting and digging. I have a newsletter that is private to a very small group of researchers, and maybe one day I'll make that more public. I'm going to be putting up older issues on the About the Sky website any day, and now that I've set it on the air, I've got to really do it.
Mm-hmm. All right, sounds good. We'll have these linked up. Thank you again, Sophia, for coming on. We'll speak soon again.
Thank you, Henrik. What a lovely opportunity you gave me.
We have William Mullen on the origins of Egyptian hieroglyphics and the connection to the ancient sky of plasma and catastrophe. Next on Red Eyes Radio, we also have John King, Kong Pop Yuyen, Barbara Peterson, Karen Hudes, Christopher Bolin, and many more coming on the program as well. For this time, we say thank you for listening, and thank you for considering and thinking. We'll be back in just a few days. Great job by the Red Eyes crew, as usual. And of course, we couldn't do this without you, our members. So our appreciation and gratitude goes out to all of you guys. Thank you so much. We'll speak to you soon. Take care and stay safe.